Welcome to the Fundraising Talent Podcast. I'm Kyla Daw, and I'm glad you decided to join us on today's episode of the show that is shaping how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent. Rather than advice from experts, our listeners want to hear the insights and ideas from those who, just like them, are on the front lines every day, building meaningful relationships that translate into meaningful support for causes that they and their donors care about. Every week, we invite our guests to have a real conversation about what it means to be a fundraising professional. We're after a greater understanding of what it means to be one of the sector's critically important yet least understood roles, while giving honest answers to our profession's most difficult questions. Thank you for joining us in this episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. Here's your host, author, fundraiser, and master trainer, Jason Lewis.
Hi, podcast listeners. This is Jason Lewis, and I'm your host for the Fundraising Talent Podcast. I want to thank you for joining us today for the show that is shaping the way that the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent. Every week, we want to have honest conversations about what it means to be in one of the sector's least understood, yet most critical roles. Before I introduce today's guest, I do want to remind everyone that my four fundraising frameworks are available to your organization. All you've got to do is go to my website, click on the toolbox, and download this free resource. Inside the toolbox, you will find four frameworks, 1, 2, 3, 4, that will help your organization ensure that everyone understands how fundraising really works. Not quite so sure what I'm talking about, you will have a framework for distinguishing between fundraising cultures, a planning framework that ensures your fundraising efforts are responsive to the opportunities available to your organization, a campaign planning framework for any major fundraising initiative, and as if that's not enough, how about a KPI scorecard that combines my fascination with the science of expertise with your determination to raise more money? If you'd like to download this free resource, go to my website, lewisfundraising.com/toolbox. Again, that's lewisfundraising.com/toolbox. I'll also put a link in the show notes. This week, my guest is Judy North. Judy has 18 years of fundraising experience in private higher education, in higher education and social services as well. Most of her time is focused on capacity building, cultures, and philanthropy and relationships. Judy also has spent some time doing some consulting as well. Hi, Judy. Thank you for being on the show with me today.
Hi, Jason. Thanks for inviting me.
Yeah. So you want to just briefly introduce yourself to our listeners and maybe tell them why fundraising matters to you. What does it mean to be a fundraiser to you?
Hi, great listeners. Fundraising to me is a great opportunity for me to use the skills and experience I have to give back to the communities that wish to support others in their different organizations that would not otherwise be able to be helped. I enjoy working with my donors, my lead donors, board members, and internal staff to strengthen fundraising programs to meet the missions that they serve.
Yeah. So Judy, before you and I hit the record button, you and I were talking a little bit about this notion of sort of the culture, both on an internal level and sometimes an external level, that is oftentimes diminishing the role of expertise that the fundraising professional themselves can be, like I often say, recognized and admired for. What has been your sort of observation with that thought, internally, externally, yeah. Either way?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think I believe oftentimes fundraisers, we come in with profound experience in our best practices for our career and our knowledge base, if you will, of what we want to see done to raise money and how we want to get that done. And I think at the outset, correct questions or appropriate questions during an interview process with leadership and your AD could be helpful in understanding the culture that is within the organization. How well does leadership get involved in fundraising, but not how well, how experienced they are. Are they apprehensive in talking with donors, or are they somebody that likes to be the only person in the room talking with donors? I've seen both sides. And with that can be challenging for the lead fundraiser themselves to be able to be effective in speaking with donors and getting gifts when their partnership with their ED doesn't seem to have the transparency as far as each being humble enough to know what they know and being able to partner with each other to be successful in those asks. From the consultant side, I've seen that consultants come in with their great experience, but that partnership is also equally important so that when the lead fundraiser is working with their prospects, that should be the relationship that should be building, not necessarily with the consultant. So if you're partnering correctly with your consultant, that can be fantastic. So that when the consultant moves on to their next project and you're finished with them, you still have that great solid relationship with your donors. And if it's not planned correctly or discussed ahead of time, that can be very challenging.
So you and I have a very similar history in terms of our length of time in the field. We've both been in the field for about 2 decades. Would you say this problem is greater or worse than, say, when you came in, when you started, say, almost 20 years ago?
From the consultant standpoint, I've only had experience with a consultant in the last 10 years, so I can't speak to that on a multiple decade. But from, I would say it's probably similar in my experience in the 2 decades of fundraising, because in the different organizations I've been with, each ED has had a different level of knowledge and experience in fundraising. Some were great at it and were good partners. Others were great at it and didn't want partnership. And then others don't want anything to do with it. And you are left to really making some decisions that really probably should have been at the senior leadership level with the board of directors and the ED. And I see that very similar over the 2 decades.
Yeah. And you work with, and your experiences in private education, which some of my background is as well. And so I oftentimes see this, okay, so you have a school culture, right? You have this very internally focused school culture that oftentimes doesn't see anything in terms of revenue, where the money comes from. The only person they tend to see is the tuition paying parent, and I think they and so the internal culture sort of tends to dismiss or miss the idea of the major donor being a prospective donor. Do you think that in some way sort of contributes to this diminished role, certainly not even necessarily an intentional diminishment, if that's even a word, of the fundraiser's role. But do you think that's in part because they diminish the role of the donor? Does that make sense?
It does make sense. I don't know if it diminishes the role of the donor. I think it's overlooked. I think that in the school culture, if you rely on your parents with the expectation to give, and you've got to build the culture of philanthropy so they understand why they need to give. There are, you know, a handful of schools across the country that actually don't rely on their annual fund to balance their budget. And for those that have to rely on the annual fund to balance their budget, there needs to be a better understanding throughout the community, the school community, to understand why tuition doesn't cover those expenses and what's needed to bridge that gap, which is not the term you ever want to use when talking with a donor, but it's that building the culture of philanthropy, helping everybody to understand what's required to make the school function as a whole and how they can be a part of that process. And through that, you're identifying your major donors that could give some more than some of your parents that really struggled to just pay the tuition.
So where have you seen that really work well? I mean, I think about the number of schools that I've worked with in the last 5 years and the ability for them to distinguish between the two roles, between the tuition paying parent and the major donor, even though sometimes they can be one and the same. The ability to create sort of a pattern of experiences and opportunities for those two different roles is oftentimes very difficult. And they also, when it comes to the fundraising professional, in school settings, I tend to see this assumption, sort of like the tuition-paying parent. So when you think about a private school setting, the tuition-paying parent is generally coming to the school. So it's almost like the function, the way in which the interaction with an admissions director works. You assume that the parent will come to your door and they will come to you. But in a fundraising environment, and part of what that culture of philanthropy would look like, is we understand as fundraisers that there's almost this, like, we have to leave the building. We have to go to you. And so there's a different sort of pattern of movement. Are you following my thought there?
Yes, I am. Yeah. So I've seen that work well. Actually, I had the, pleasure of working at a school in Seattle, Washington, in that vicinity. And that is one of the schools in the country where they did not have to rely on the annual fund to balance their budget.
Yeah.
And so in speaking with parents about the annual fund, they were, you know, we were building the culture of philanthropy among those parents, having wonderful conversations. The head of school was very comfortable having conversations with those donors that had the capacity to give more than an annual gift. And we were building a major gift program. And in that school, it really worked well, the partnership between myself and the growing partnership between myself and the head of school. But the leadership team there was really on board with what needed to happen to build that program from a philanthropy standpoint, and were very supportive amongst each of the colleagues on that leadership team for each other's role. So the partnership internally at that leadership level was a sense of comfort to be able to go and do what I needed to start those conversations with parents, because it was a trust among the internal team and mutual respect. So that when you go and you talk with those parents about the gifts and what the needs are of the school, that was evident, and those conversations were very easy to have. On the flip side, having worked at a school where annual fund was absolutely reliant to balance the budget, there was not mutual respect among the leadership team. It made those conversations with those leadership donors much more difficult, because that mutual respect was missing at that in that particular culture. So I think it really is dependent on the culture and how you are able to work through those conversations initially when you're actually looking to go into a new culture, that you're got those questions that you have ahead of time to make sure you're fitting into their culture and that it's going to work for you so that you've got success.
So I know you've done some consulting, and you've worked, again, you and I have worked in the same sort of spaces. I've worked in a lot of private independent schools. And when we shift the sort of the topic of conversation to the role of the consultant as it relates to elevating the role of as we sort of say that the consultant should elevate the expertise or increase the expertise of the fundraiser who's there on the front line. Some of the things that I'm saying, Judy, out in my seminars is I'm advocating for a consultant that in time, I'm envisioning a consultant that 10 years from now is no longer carrying out feasibility studies, for example, and being hired in to administrate capital campaigns, largely because that level of experience and expectation is with the development officer. And that's all, but that's not to say that the role of the consultant totally goes away. It's just the role that they begin to play is different. Do you see where that could, as we sort of, I tend to think that the role of the consultant has historically been what it has been, feasibility studies and capital campaign administration or whatever you call it, tends to be that way because of the lack of expertise that we've expected of the fundraiser. And as that expertise in-house matures, we won't need them to deliver on the same type of service as consistently. Do you see that?
I do see that, and I agree with you. I think as the experience of fundraisers across the country does mature and get the experience they need, that I agree with you, they would not need the consultants in that way. I think also partly why we rely on consultants the same way and have for so long is because these development offices don't have the staff to execute a capital campaign properly and timely without that outside resource. But I can definitely see where as the experience matures and people get more confident in being able to put together their own feasibility study and kick off a capital campaign, that need would subside slightly. I do see that.
Yeah. I've gotten some pushback from people who've been consulting a lot longer than you and I probably have, and they don't like my use of the term. They haven't gone on record for pushing back on this. They haven't, but they don't like my use of the term messy adolescence, which is the term that I sort of apply to the fundraising profession. But what they're also pushing back on is this notion that some of the deliverables that consultants are delivering on today or historically have delivered on will not be the same in the future. And so I think it's that our toolbox, the toolbox that the consultant walks in the door with is just an evolving, changing toolbox.
Right.
You know, my coaching work, I mean, my work as a consultant tends to resemble more of a coach. And really much more in like, to use your word, raising that fundraiser's confidence in the field than it is essentially administrating, carrying out work that, quite frankly, I think they should be just as capable of doing.
Right. And I think partnership with the fundraiser and their ED, as they mature in their fundraising, the ED will mature in their role and be more comfortable with the fundraising process, so that bringing the consultant role internally to do those feasibility studies is a stronger partnership. Again, that word, it keeps coming up, but a stronger partnership to be able to use, create all of that momentum in-house without that need for the consultant. You might need them in a different way, for sure.
Yeah. I definitely see the value of sort of the external. I don't question the usefulness. We'd be shooting ourselves in the foot if we question the usefulness of our roles.
Right.
But I think it's very necessary that we continuously raise the bar for the fundraiser, the employed fundraiser, and consequently for those of us who are enlisted to help them, are called upon to do the same thing. Judy, I know you didn't have a lot of time. I'm really glad we connected today. One more question I do have for you. Where have you seen that and you offered the example with the relationship you had when you were up in the Pacific Northwest.
In Seattle, yeah.
Yeah, up in Seattle. I'm interested to hear maybe just a continuation of that, maybe that example of where you've seen both the consultant and the supervisor, we'll call him the CEO, he or she the CEO, really sort of work together to elevate the frontline fundraiser. Have you seen that or experienced that where you could see that these two people sort of working in tandem to elevate the role of the fundraiser?
I would actually go back to that same school, because when I started there, they were in the middle of a capital campaign and I came into that, and the partnership with the consultant, working with that head of school, had already built the relationships necessary. So when I came in, it was a seamless transition. And she was really great at helping me build the relationships with the parents, the current parents at the school, so that she actually kind of stepped off into the side and helped me be the leader and become the front face of that campaign. And that worked really, really well.
And was there a consultant in the relationship as well?
She was a consultant managing the capital campaign.
Okay.
And then I came in as the director of development. So then as bringing me in, she stepped back a little bit and was kind of helping me behind the scenes, and helped me move more towards the front to be the front facing person.
Okay. I'm sorry, I missed that. Okay. So yeah, she was describing the not the CEO, but the and you would say that the CEO,
correct.
So the CEO, your boss at the time, certainly expected that and that's what they wanted to see.
Yes, that was part of the agreement once I came on, is to help keep the consultant on to keep us on task and on target and line with where we needed to be, but to move aside and let me be that front-facing person with the leadership that I had in place for the campaign, the board, and the head of school.
Yeah, okay. Well, listen, Judy, I'm glad we caught some time for a brief introduction and to talk about fundraising a little bit. People know how to reach out to me, but if somebody's listening to something you said today and they want to reach out to you, how might be the best way for them to do that?
They could connect with me on my profile through LinkedIn.
Okay.
They're more than welcome to reach me there.
Okay. Yes. And you and I are connected that way too. So I will make sure to put your profile in the show notes. And I look forward to meeting you in person at some point. It's been a pleasure.
Great. Thank you. It was a pleasure. Thank you, Jason. Bye-bye.
Have you read the book that nonprofit leaders and fundraising professionals alike are calling a must read? In this pocket manifesto for today's fundraising professional, Jason deconstructs why many of us find ourselves working for organizations where we cannot accomplish our goals. These same organizations are notorious for rapid turnover and high donor attrition. To avoid this all too familiar path, Jason offers direction from those who want to be recognized and admired for their work. The war for fundraising talent challenges our ingrained beliefs and assumptions about how effective fundraising really works, and it questions the prevailing wisdom hiring decisions and donor behavior. Published by Gatekeepers Press, The War for Fundraising Talent is now available on Amazon and other major retailers. We want to thank you for listening to today's episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. We hope you enjoyed today's show and hope you will come back for next week's interview, where we will discuss with those on the front line who are defining what it means to be a fundraising professional. If you'd like to be a guest on the Fundraising Talent Podcast, visit our Facebook page or email Jason at jason@lewisfundraising.com. In your email, be sure to tell us about where you work and why you believe you would be a great addition to the upcoming lineup. Thank you again for joining us today, and we look forward to you being a part of the continuing conversation as we shape how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent.